You're pointing it towards me.
Because you're the farthest away.
I know, but I'm also the loudest.
Yeah. Wow. This part-
Welcome to Infill, where we discuss local San Francisco politics and policy. I'm Laura Clark, YIMBY Action, and here with Sam Moss.
From Mission Housing Development Corporation.
And special guests today are friends at San Francisco Housing Action Coalition, known as the HAC.
Hey, I'm David, Executive Director. Nice to see you.
And Corey Smith.
Yeah, here's the mail-based
Laura's
podcast.
Just hanging out with three white dudes.
Oh, man. All right, cool. But I like you guys. And when I need to take
to
a
face.
White male to a meeting in order to make sure that somebody listens to me, you guys all often come.
No
so
problem.
Thanks.
It's helpful because Laura tells us what to say. It sounds smarter that way. So
yeah, I wish I could do all the meetings that way. It'd be helpful.
All right, so today we're going to talk about the mayor's directive, which was an awesome... from Mr. Head Honcho to the various departments, thou shalt expedite housing.
Thou shalt build housing.
Well, yes, thou shalt build housing.
Expedite the building of housing.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we'll get into the blah, but we're also going to talk about,
like...
Did
they see that on radio? No.
And then we're going to talk about other NIMBY strategies that are cropping up since we passed SB 35, ADUs, like historical districting, lot mergers. There's a whole bunch of things coming in the pipeline.
Infrastructure.
How are people going to oppose housing now? And then we have a little bit from Sam Moss, who just wants to say what a Richmond special is.
A Richmond special is important to know.
Okay.
Everybody. We'll get there.
And I think that's it. So, mayor's directive. The mayor came out and was like, y'all, we're going to do 5,000 a year every year.
5,000 new units of housing?
Yes. It might be on some hack stickers.
Where did 5,000 come from?
So, 5,000 originally came from Ted Egan, actually. It was the city itself. So, Ted Egan is the city's chief economist. He said that building 5,000 units per year in San Francisco means that prices increase at the exact same rate as inflation. So, effectively flat. Been an SF hack messaging and kind of target goal for about 10 years now, probably. And for the last time, sorry, for the first time since the 40s, we actually hit that number as a city in 2016, and oh my gosh, rents fell at the early part of 2017.
That's
supply and demand. Who would have thunk it?
Myth.
Is it?
I don't believe you.
Is it units that are on coming that have come online, or is it permitted? Like, is it actual physical space for humans to move into?
We actually opened up 5,000 total units in San Francisco for people to move into. That's a combination of market rate and subsidized affordable, of rental and ownership. It's just kind of the big umbrella number. That's what what the mayor has said we need to hit every single year going forward.
Is that to make his directive, or is there a new directive?
This is a new directive. So, like, before it was just like a thing people said.
Well, no, because he said when he was running the last time, right? He said 30,000 units or something by 2020.
There's 30,000, but that was just sort of like, wouldn't that be nice? Like,
But we're actually on track to hit that directive. I mean, the Mayor's Office of Housing, I believe when he made that initial directive, or the initial goal, rather, we needed to hit what ended up being around 5,000 per year. And we're actually trending, for some odd reason, which actually doesn't make sense now that I think about this, to the goal. It was 30,000 a year by 2020, and we had a slow start. But now we are at the point where we're actually possible to achieve that goal.
2015,
if we built
5,000. 14?
13.
13, that's what I meant.
Look, there are a bunch of mega projects that are coming online. There are a bunch of mega projects in the pipeline still. But potentially where this could be really useful is in what we like sort of call missing middle. Mm-hmm. So the mayor's directive is going to focus on the post-entitlement process. So we often talk about how fucked up the pre-entitlement process is. So that's like getting your permits to say, yes, you can build it. And then after you get the, like, yes, you can build it permit, you actually have to go get all of the, like, dig a hole permit. And
all the building, like, permits.
Yeah.
There's, like, entitling your project because you're entitled to build it. And then you have to go talk to other, like, city agencies that don't care about you being entitled to build.
I talked to this developer who had actually the funniest thing to say. They called the building permit the permit to go get more permits.
The build. That's what it is, though.
Now that you're entitled, you are entitled to go request more permits in order to build your building.
Lucky you. Lucky you.
And the rule is, like, no one's allowed to talk to anybody.
Well, yeah, you know? So with the alphabet soup, all of these different, like, building permit, like, the each department, so this is where the mayor's office can actually, like, drop the hammer, is that there are all these different departments that are responsible for the dig a hole permit, the fire department, the building. None of them actually, like, coordinate with one another. None of them have any, they're not, their primary interest is not in permitting housing. And so they all kind of put a lot of the stuff at the bottom of their list and don't have a good system for getting the post-entitlement permits through their system. And so potentially the mayor is like, hey, y'all, speed this up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that, I don't know if it's written in the directive, but one of the things that the mayor's definitely talking about is that each department will have a housing czar, right, that is making sure that whatever that department needs to do to build housing is actually doing those things.
Each department will get
each
one?
Each department.
There's a lot of czars.
There are a lot of czars. Yeah, yeah. But you know what? It's better to have more housing czars than fewer.
Well, I guess that needs to be seen.
And at SFMTA, it's not their responsibility to build housing. At Public Works, it's not their responsibility to build housing. At, you know, Recology, it is not their responsibility to build housing. So once we actually get somebody thinking about it, it is theoretically going to make things move faster.
And it's important to, I mean, like, as an activist, it's important to have a person to yell at.
Yeah.
That, like,
totally agree.
Like, oh, the biggest,
I mean, that's what we have Todd for, right?
It's important. Like, the biggest thing I'm excited about with the whole mayor's directive is that there's this post-entitlement permitting that there's no data collection about. There's no understanding of actually what are all the hurdles that you have to go through. There's no, like, how long. I've asked so many people, I can't get a good answer from anyone in the department to give me any estimate of how long the average project takes to get through the post-entitlement permitting process. They just, like, they're like, oh, huh, let me think about that and get back to you. And then, like, no.
We estimate, like, 18 months or so.
And
like,
that's
you
for
get
four
entitled, and then you, I mean, we were the, I would say that's minimum. Yeah, right. For sure. It's very frustrating. I mean, we inherited, we won a fully entitled development. Mm-hmm. At the corner of 16th and South NS, and we're almost 2 years into it now. We're almost there, but
almost. When you say almost there, that means,
I mean, like, we're
shoveling the ground.
Yeah. I mean,
so,
that,
so 18. So how long has
we
it been?
We won it over a year ago, a little bit less than a year and a half, and that has also some things to do with affordable housing funding and the cycles. But to get the building permits afterwards takes a very long time. And the departments don't really talk to each other. And even if they did, it's like Laura said, there's no one saying, hey, everyone, our goal should be to build this housing efficiently and get it online. Like, no one until now, hopefully, has been thinking about that, like a concerted effort to work together to build the thing.
So, Sam, one of the questions that I hear all the time, or I'm asked all the time, is that, is there one thing, like, that if we could change that would speed up the creation of housing? And so in from a affordable housing developer point of view, going through this process and having bought a, or bought, I assume, an entitled project, what is there, from your point of view, is there one thing, or is it multiple?
I mean, there's one thing, but it overarches. Yeah. Like, if we make affordable housing development buy right, just literally buy right, and we map out a way for that to be executed both pre and post entitlement, sure, that will make it a lot faster. But that's a bunch of different departments that we'll all have to write, you know, process for. And I mean, I believe that can happen, but that's the one thing. But I guess I'm cheating because it overarches on a bunch of different things.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot. This is the other hard thing is that, like, you know, I get asked this all the time. People are like, what's the one law?
And you're how do we hack affordable housing? Right.
Oh, yeah. How do we, you know, what's the one thing that we could change that would change everything? And it's like, oh, well, that's an impossible question. I mean, it took 30 years of bad policymaking to dig us into this hole.
And to create the NIMBYs, so.
Yes, woohoo. I'm so glad that things are so terrible that people just saying build housing is like a novel thing.
I mean, I have to say I'm a little disappointed that the you know, the attention is brought away from public education to affordable housing, because like now, like Laura and Sam and Corey, they're so concerned that they're not even going to be able to live in San Francisco that, you know, the public education thing is a totally
distant.
I'm going to fix that too.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Sam, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we could add the list of things that I would like to be working on more than, like, shelter.
Well, it's like affordable housing fixes everything. Public education, too. Don't worry about the data. It does. It fixes everything.
Yeah. And you know what I like to answer, though, for the people who are like, what's the one thing? And I'll be like, Prop 13 reform.
Oh.
And
that's impossible.
Yeah, that won't happen.
Exactly.
Sam, that's impossible.
No, I'm into it. Okay, cool. So I think we sort of beat that horse to death. Well, I don't know. I mean, do anybody else want to talk about
the one thing I do think that's exciting about it is Laura mentioned the idea that there's actually somebody now to yell at each department. The fact that the mayor has stated that it needs to be a priority for every department means that we are more likely to actually get a schedule and a timeline for things to get done, because one of the big issues that does exist is there's no deadlines for a lot of this stuff. And
does each department have to keep records about every when something comes into it and when it's approved?
So one of the exciting things about it as well is the mayor has indicated a desire and a necessity to have metrics tied into the entire process. That's something that everybody around this microphone has been advocating for a long time. We are currently convening different departments to be like, hey, which metrics make sense? You know, let's keep it simple. Let's make sure it's easily trackable. And let's make sure that if we are on track to achieve our goals, that we are celebrating those wins. And if we're not, let's change something and make sure that, hey, okay, now we know we are, you know, en route to success. So, it's a more data-driven approach, and department by department is going to be more accountable because there is somebody in charge. And if they are screwing up, the chief executive of the city of San Francisco has the ability to fire people, I believe.
Yeah.
Which is exciting.
I mean, the really cool thing also is that, like, you know, we were invited to be part of the roundtable and the, like, you know, we were... This is a big step for San Francisco YIMBY party to be become a part of the thing that we loathe,
literally,
which is
at the
table. Establishment. Yes. You know, the chair was pulled out for us and we were at the physical table where the mayor comes and makes the announcement and the press is there and discusses all these things. You know, that was really exciting.
It was a very proud moment.
It was a very proud moment. Yeah. I mean, well, I don't know, you know, because...
I mean, I was sitting in between you, Randy Shaw, Todd was nearby. Well, no, I was between you, Todd, and Laura, which is where I want to be all the time, pretty much, you know?
I mean, it's really exciting, but I also worry about it, right? Because when you become... This is like activist thing. When you're outside of the system, it's very easy to yell at the system and to say, here are all the things that aren't working. And then once you're at the table, you become an apologist for why things aren't working. Like, often. Not all the time, and I try to promise to say that I won't do that. But, like, once you're at the table, you're like, well, the reason that it didn't work out, that we weren't able to accomplish that, is because of, like, this really complicated thing, and you need to understand. And previously, I've had the luxury of being like, no, fuck you. You should have done it. Fight harder. Like, be angry all the time. Rah,
I feel
rah,
like
rah.
If you were better at sports, there'd be a good sports reference there.
Okay, but, I don't know what
you know, the underdog, if you will.
Ooh, okay.
It's always easier to be the underdog. feel like that's the right sports reference.
I mean, it's
definitely not easier being in the underdog.
I don't know, but it's really, you get all this moral high ground, right? You get to be like, you know? And like, you know, once you're part of the system, you have to sacrifice some of your moral high ground.
I don't know that we should just be part of the system.
We should just have good people being the front runners. It'll make life easier.
I promise to stay angry. How about that?
I have no doubt.
Once you are a clear front runner, we trust your ability to show good moral judgment.
Maybe it's not easier to be the underdog, but you can be more aggressive. You can say things. You can do things that, when you're at the table and being held accountable for, it seems a little harder to do. What do you think about that, Todd?
No. I mean, this is just my experience. I feel like that what Laura is bringing up is something that is brought up quite a bit, but I think it really gets into the question as to why anyone gets involved in the issues that they care about. Like, you know, I do think that there are certain people that do get involved in issues to be a person at the table. And once they're there, they just kind of want to keep the status quo. That does not concern me about you, Laura. Like, that is not, right? Like, it is about, right? There are other people who are like, I want to solve a problem. And if being at the table help solve that problem, awesome. If being on that table and putting your finger at people being like, you are not helping me solve this problem, that's where I think you would be. And so, I don't think that everyone who ends up at the table views it in the same light. It's some people, like, I do think there are some people like Sam who just want to be at the table, and there are some people like Laura.
then there are some people like Laura
who actually want to solve a problem. That's what I think.
Yeah, because I look at other, I mean, this is, you know, a thing we've been talking about a lot recently, is that, like, you know, people form an organization, and then they become very invested in the perpetuation of that organization rather than solving the problem. And, you know, that's a toxic force that happens to nonprofits, especially, like, all over the place, you know, that they become invested in, okay, you know, how much money do we need to raise in order to perpetuate ourselves? And they're, like, just, like, grant-writing machines.
Yeah, I think that, you know, anyone who works in the nonprofit world has to admit that there is a perverse disincentive to be, like, if we actually solve the problem that we were created to solve, then we're out of a job.
Right.
Which is such a ludicrous fear to have, because if you could actually solve housing in San Francisco, you're pretty much employable everywhere else in the world. So it won't be a problem.
On the other hand, though, like, if we were to make affordable housing by right, where I don't have to go to whatever, the Excelsior for a bazillion hours over a year to, like, convince them that affordable housing is good, technically that is me working towards a big part of, like, why I'm hired going away, but that sounds awesome. I would love to not have to do that.
So on that note of, like, you being great at community meetings, which we've talked about many times, so irritating
and
to me.
And everyone thinks the same thing, that I am awesome at it.
Yeah, you're great at it. Blah, blah.
Everyone.
It was interesting to me that a supposed affordable housing activist who shall not be named at a hearing today. So we all went to a hearing today at OCII to talk about a homeless, formerly homeless, because they'll be housed.
If you live in Mission Bay, reach out to the OCII Commission to support supportive housing at Block 9.
Right. So this is formerly homeless supportive housing. And an affordable housing supposed activist, who shall not be named, made comments about how affordable housing, the most important thing that they do is reach out to the community, and that the community meetings are really important because they help the community get, like, comfortable with having affordable housing in their neighborhoods and blah, 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 blah. And I was, you know, that seems bizarre to me, because actually, yeah, I mean, we should have affordable housing, people, like, connect with the community, but also this seems like a way to enable NIMBYism and to waste affordable housing developers' time and to create a situation in which you actually just end up stoking some fears, because instead of just affordable housing happening in their neighborhoods and like them being like, oh, huh, that's a new development that like seems pretty nice, and I didn't know that those people were super low income, because actually I didn't even notice, because actually low income people do not have horns, and formerly homeless people in fact are just like everybody else, and they live in our communities and we all go on with our lives. Instead, you create this thing where you have to spend months and months and months and months, you know, acclimatizing higher income people to the fact that they're suddenly going to have low income people in their community clutching my pearls. You know, I just think that this, you know, it's unhealthy.
No, I mean, you bring up a good point. I wonder what would happen if we would just go in and say we're a real estate developer, you know, and we're just building units and just not say anything about it. That's a really good point. I will think about that. I think that that's like when the he who shall not be named said it. That's like a throwback from he inherited the redevelopment, you know, whatever, where anytime anyone hears affordable housing, especially if they're older or they're a homeowner in San Francisco, they think slum, redevelopment, there's going to be a giant tower, you know, blah, blah. And that's usually the the point of view that we come into it from, is that I will admit, yes, I assume that every single person in that neighborhood is not going to want the affordable housing in the beginning. That's like how I determine what I say to people, how I like plan out, how we plan out our community organizing. And I don't know, maybe we should stop doing that. We could just say we're a real estate development corporation bringing in high-end condos.
I mean, because they are expensive. You can just say, I'm building some expensive shit in your neighborhood.
Here, Forsyl. Here's some high-end senior housing.
The thing that he really does, that Sam does bring up, that there is a lot of benefit that does come from the community process and talking with people, is that there are a bunch of people who are scared of it early on, and the community process lets them be educated about the event or about the project, so they can be supportive.
It does enable them to think that they control the project, though. It enables them to think that we control the project. We get to say everything.
The neighborhood gets to decide what happens here.
But most people aren't actively working productively within the community to answer questions directly. We've been to affordable housing community meetings where people skirt around questions, and not everybody approaches it the same way that Sam does.
Say what?
And actually,
cost-benefit analysis. Anyway, Todd. Yeah.
You know, I think that there is a demographic that is not a small demographic that is becoming very sophisticated in using coded language. And whether it's purposeful or not, I do think that the coded language, and to a certain extent, I think it actually think it It encourages well-meaning people to perhaps do and support positions that they would not normally support. And so, you know, I just think that, you know, sophisticated arguments to stop, to question the reasonableness of moving different others into a neighborhood, I think we all just need to really, like, look at and question whether the what they're saying is legitimate to the issue at hand, or if it's coded to try to for another purpose.
And on top of that, everyone who says fine whatever and doesn't come to all 14 community meetings, that vote is never counted, right? Those that fine whatever I don't care is a critical component of getting affordable housing built that is never incorporated.
It's just the loud people.
It's just the loud people. And like that guy today who said, what was his line? He said he had toured. So this is a perfect example of somebody who's going to be loud forever and terrible. He was like, I've been and I've now toured a bunch of supportive housing, and I've spoken with the police and other people and the police officers. That was the part where I was like, oh, this is getting really sick. The police officers especially told him, fight this with everything you have.
What?
Yeah. And like, you know, and I was like, wow, we took somebody who was just your basic NIMBY, then we educated him on like how to engage with the system and also agitated him. All these community meetings, all they have done is make him feel more empowered to quote unquote fight this with everything you can. And like, there he is up there saying
fighting with everything.
Yeah. And so, I don't know that that's, like, how is this a healthy system when all of the sure whatever people cannot possibly be measured in any demonstrable way?
So if there are 10 people that show up to a first community meeting, how many of them are going to be opposed no matter what? How many of them are going to be supportive no matter what? And how many of them are actually legitimately searching for a couple of questions or a couple of answers?
Concern, the genuine concern. The genuine concerns. Yeah.
I think that, like, depends on the neighborhood or the town. You know, if we're in the Mission, then almost 7 or 8 of them will be for it, maybe want to ask a question. But, I mean, that's been our experience, at least, organizing in the Mission.
And that's why affordable housing only gets built in historically low-income and minority
Correct.
Neighborhoods.
Right.
And doesn't get built in pearl-clutching
neighborhoods. So let's take that and say that there was a, you know, 40-unit affordable housing project in the Marina. In the Marina.
I mean,
I love it.
That would be awesome.
Right, so of that, I would say 10 of 10 people. Right. How many of them are supportive no matter what?
Zero.
How many of them are opposed no matter what?
And
how
100%.
Many? Of, 5 or 6.
And then how many of them are actually asking legitimate questions? Let's say 6 are opposed. No. Because they're fair. If you don't know, having
6, 1, 3.
No, but the thing is, why do the 10 people who come to that freaking community meeting matter more than the, like, 300 people who got their notification, said, I don't care, and threw it in the trash?
Because people who show up get to make decisions.
Right. Okay, so, but, like, we have to fix that. Because, like, it's not functional. Like,
it's not. Saying, only the
no,
crazy show.
I want to, like,
we're agitate. Crazy.
Yimbys need to Lumpy. Engage with the system so that we don't have to, like, decisions need to be made at a higher level. And, like, we need Yimbys to, like, come up and show up and be angry at all of these stupid asinine hearings and do it over and over and over again. But, like, this is not a functional system. We can't say that Yimbys need to be active at all of these asinine community hearings for the next 30 years.
No, it's to stop
forever?
The need. It's to stop the need to have the meeting
yes.
the way that it is. Yeah. We need to definitely show up to point out that most people can't show up to
I mean,
the
only
quote-unquote democratic process.
The only thing that keeps me sane in all these things is live tweeting my, like, little rageful nonsense. And
if you're not following, it's at SFYMBY. That's YIMBY.
And it is worth
you're certainly not listening to the podcast if you don't already follow the
everyone
Twitter handle.
Yeah, everyone that listens to the podcast probably follows. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, otherwise I'd lose my goddamn mind. Already have. All right, we've gone on about this topic, but I think actually this is a good pivot to, so, like, now that we are starting to have some wins, as usual, we play whack-a-mole. And so there's all these new ways on the local level, on the state level, that NIMBYs are trying to avoid SB 35. This will be like a whole series of whack-a-moles that we're going to have to play going forward with HOMSF, the density bonus. So you guys want to talk about transit. I want to talk about lot mergers. And we should also talk about the fucking residential expansion threshold. Yeah. But talk about transit.
So we've been early on seeing some people speak out that the city does not have the transit infrastructure, you know, citywide to support the housing that we are advocating for. And it's an interesting argument, and you'll actually see a piece coming out in the Bay City Beacon, co-authored by Todd and I, about how to really approach that. And I think Todd's kind of got a good perspective on this. So it seems like the supply and demand is not a real thing argument is done. That's kind of what we're reading.
I'm gonna miss that.
Yeah, I don't know that's true, but
like,
okay.
I'm a little sad.
We're going on gravity next, but Todd, where do you see the next argument to oppose housing come from?
I mean, I don't think that this differs very much from, like, the more, like, sophisticated kind of questioning that I was bringing up in the last segment. What I think is that there's going to be, so I agree with Corey 100%, that I do think the supply and demand argument has been won. I think there will be some people who will hold on to it with dear life, but at the end of the day, I think that...
We'll take an apple and drop it on their head and see if gravity's
working. Yeah. Exactly. And so now I think that people are going to want to get a little bit more nuanced and say, like, oh, so perhaps we don't have the infrastructure to build the housing that we all desperately know we need. And so, maybe we shouldn't build it because we don't have the infrastructure there. You know, and so what I would say is that, you know, I think that it is unresolved as to whether the infrastructure needs to come before the housing or the housing needs to come before the infrastructure. What I would say is that as urbanists and inclusive believers, we need both. And we should not allow, like, the debate of which one should come first to stop either from happening. We need both to be happening. So when you hear people bringing up the argument of, like, oh, we don't have the infrastructure, I think it is totally reasonable for you to question, are they really asking that question, or are they just being another NIMBY to say, like, let's not invite these people to the neighborhood?
Fair. So how do we actually make sure that it happens at the same time? How does that happen?
Does it happen at the same time?
This is a chicken and egg problem. It's a trap. It's a trap, right?
Okay, Admiral Akbar. It's a trap. And
it
get me some
squid. At the same time. Like, it just doesn't. You do one, you do the other. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can always run more bus lines. Like, these things go hand in hand, sure. But, like, you can't use one as an excuse not to do the other. You can't use the other as an excuse not to do the one. We've chronically underfunded our transit. # Prop 13. But, like, all of this is we do both at the same time, always.
Like, and whenever it's possible.
Yeah, but of course, the argument then, playing devil's advocate, is city government's not that efficient.
Okay, so let's just jump off the nearest cliff. Right? I mean, I'm sorry, but, like, you know, oh, city government's not efficient. Whose fault is that? Right? That's our fault. Like, if city government's not efficient, then, like, let's fix that problem, too.
So you think we can have muni lines, have more buses, have potentially an underground subway system at the same time as we build more housing?
I know, it's just, like, crazy. I talked to somebody today who was like, well, the, you know, high-speed rail or whatever transit thing isn't going to be revenue neutral. And I was like, no, and our highway system isn't revenue neutral either. We decided long ago that cars produced economic outcomes that were beneficial enough that we were just going to throw money at it for the foreseeable future. And that was a fucking mistake.
I mean, isn't the mortgage interest tax deduction?
Yeah, this is not
housing, single-family homes,
neutral.
Right?
Yeah.
Quote neutral.
Like,
we both know you didn't buy your home.
Okay. There are things that are public goods that are not revenue... I don't know how I'm going to edit that. There are things that are public goods that are never going to be revenue neutral.
Right? All the farms, so, everything?
Food is subsidized. Farming subsidized is not necessarily a good argument because, like, corn is really fucked up. So, like, let's not go there. But...
So I just have an opinion on corn prices.
We'll get there.
I have a strong opinion about corn subsidies.
Next year.
Yeah.
So in the interest of private and public merging with housing and transit infrastructure, housing is primarily a private industry at this point in time.
Shh, don't tell Sam.
And
it wasn't Sam.
Transportation is by and large a public good at this point in time.
Yeah, especially the public good where everyone feels like they're entitled to their free parking spot. Yeah,
that's a good point, though.
Yeah.
Good difference.
We subsidize car ownership at a rate way higher than we subsidize our transit.
So really? How can... I've always been a believer and supporter of privatized public transportation. I think that is actually... because the public sector, especially in San Francisco, has shown an inability to do it well.
That's a self-defeating... I don't like that argument.
What argument?
We shouldn't also do private mass transit. I'm for private mass transit. But we cannot, as liberals, give up on our public institutions just because San Francisco is broken. Like, we have to fix it.
Agreed. And one of the things that we wrote about in the op-ed was in the 1940s, San Francisco had dozens of rail lines all over the city.
And whatnot. Every major city did until Ford came along and was like, I'm going to eat your lunch.
Nope, we made bad decisions. In that exact voice. Didn't have much foresight. But how can we, so then in the interest of going into the future, trying to figure out how, especially the public-private sector interact from a transit perspective, I think everybody agrees we need more public investment in housing, 100%. Is there a way that the private sector can really get engaged on the transportation aspect of it to make sure that we are building the infrastructure to actually build, yes, 6 to 8 stories in the Sunset and the Richmond, because that is a good thing for the neighborhood?
This is a whole like place where I think, I don't know, I haven't actually decided what my thinking is on this. Rare, I know. Because we have this system right now. This is a fees question,
right,
ultimately.
Totally.
Because we do impact fees on development. And we say, you developer, acting as if the impact of new housing is negative, and therefore they have to pay for the infrastructure improvements.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's a bad way to do public policy. We're disincentivizing the housing, and we're acting like they should have to pay for the fact that like new humans live here, rather than all of us taxing ourselves in a normal fashion and paying for public goods, and the new residents paying as much as the old residents do, and we all just like doing public goods things together. I mean, it's this whole like, I love the POPOS, the publicly operated public open spaces.
Almost.
Isn't
I wouldn't
right?
have been able to get it on
no,
the
it's
private,
right.
privately owned public open space.
Mansplained
okay.
in the greatest way.
No, actually explained. She just got the acronym
explained.
Wrong.
Okay, so this is like a classic neoliberal thing where they're like, we should have parks. We don't want to pay for the parks. We don't want to maintain the parks. How about you, developer? We just like require you to have this like parklet thing. And then the developer makes all kind of weird decisions because they actually don't want poor people and homeless people like hanging out in their parks. Then they make them like inaccessible. So then you have like secret maps that Spur produces of like the secret popos you can like go up on hang on. And then a security guard tells you to leave, which is what happened to me recently on a popos.
Yeah, we were there together.
Were we all there?
Yeah,
the
no,
July.
That one, the security guard did not tell us. Did they tell us to leave? Oh,
yeah
they did. And I,
like four
man,
times.
I was a little drunk and told that, I forgot
time.
All about that. I was very aggressive with them.
One of the things Matt Reagan, who works for the Bay Area Council, told me recently, I thought it was really fascinating.
Great guy.
And he, it's a Joe Biden quote that I thought was good. And you talk about, transportation dollars that are generated from housing funds and impact fees and yada, yada, yada. And the quote from former VP Biden was, you know, you can go ahead and tell me your priorities, but I'd rather see your budget and I'll tell you your priorities.
Mm.
And it was the fact that we tax housing to pay for transportation. And when you apply extra taxes to housing, that means housing is harder to build, which means that housing is not a priority financially
well,
for the public sector to create. Right, exactly.
And then they're like, oh, it's all luxury. And it's like, well, you put a bunch of fees on it. What did you think was going to happen?
And taxing the new stuff like emboldens the people who are here already that own their homes to be like,
yeah.
You are coming in and you need to pay your fee. We're good.
So the city,
you need to pay your fee.
The city of San Francisco and the state of California as a whole probably needs to realize if we are actually serious about building a bunch of housing, we don't need to tax it as if it were a luxury good. I mean, it's a pretty foundational
and if only there was this one tax
people.
Measure that we could reform that would fix everything.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Well,
but I do think this coming statewide, there is going to be movement on capping fees, on doing something. There's a lot of movement about that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of potential there.
You'll
it is going to be something that everyone, you know, it's hard because the demonization of developers and being like, no, we need to put fees on the developers is so strong. You know, the fees we put on developers are so easy to demonize. And, like, I get that. Like, capitalists, whatever, they twirl their mustaches.
There's a lot of asshole developers out there, too.
Yeah. I mean, well, what did you think was going to happen when you made, like, a really cumbersome system, you know?
I mean, I'm a nice developer.
Yeah. Sure.
Literally no one in this room agreed with me when I said that for the podcast world. There were three eye rolls. Like
I'm on Laura's team.
I'm not nice.
I'm cordial.
You're very cordial.
Thank you.
Mediocre at best.
Mediocre at best. That's what I'm aiming for.
All right, so we've lost the thread. But I did want to talk about, so transit fees, all the fees, underfunding transit as a way to, I mean, this is the George Wooden quote that we all love to repeat over and over again, which is, well, you know, you got to fight the transit, because if they build the transit, they're just going to want to build more housing. That's George Wooden, San Francisco, Coalition for San Francisco Neighborhoods, the like homeowners.
So who do we tax? And what is politically feasible to actually pass to tax in order to actually pay for this?
Well, politically feasible. I mean, we have to make new things politically feasible that have not been
be the majority of voters before politically feasible will serve our goals, I think.
To some degree, I believe in incrementalism. I believe in, like, moving the ball forward and all that good stuff. I also do think that, like, if we take away small towns' abilities to do all, especially, I mean, in San Francisco, if we cap the ability for them to do all these fees, then they're going to have to budgetarily be like, oh shit, we have to tax ourselves in a normal fashion. And I actually think that will increase the appetite for Prop 13 reform.
Because can you tax yourself in a normal fashion? Like, how does that work if you want to tax yourself?
Prop 13 reform.
Right. I'm saying, like, say I have a magic wand, and I convince Lafayette to not be horrible, and they want to tax themselves so that they can build affordable housing. Are they allowed to do that?
Like, No. Prop 13, like, and the, like, you needing two-thirds to pass a lot of things, it, like, has all these ripple effects. Like, no, we do need to change Prop 13 at the state level. What the fuck are you doing?
Sorry, Steph hit his first three.
You should keep that in. That's great.
Sports are stupid.
Well, you actually would have had a good metaphor earlier if you were better at sports.
Well, I resent...
The underdog.
Okay.
Again, the Warriors are favorites, and I always prefer to be a favorite than an underdog.
All right, I have two more things on my little list of things that we were going to talk about. Number one is lot mergers and other ways that people are going to use to avoid having to do affordable housing density bonus program projects. Just, like, so people know, I don't know, we can talk about this or we cannot talk about this, but transit's a way that people are going to use as an excuse to not build housing.
Is that the residential
expansion? No, residential expansion threshold is a whole other kettle of fish that we don't have time to get into, but there will be an event coming up soon, and I will put it in the show notes. So, like, get angry about residential expansion threshold. Also, though, declaring things historic is a way to get around SB 35, and we're going to see all of these little cities and towns are going to come up with new ways to avoid and to downzone places where someone might build housing and upzone places where it's impossible to build housing. We're going to see people making it hard to do lot mergers. Lot mergers mean that you could do potentially a density bonus program or whatever.
We're already seeing that.
Yeah,
we're already seeing lot merger legislation come through the pipeline.
Yeah.
To limit building housing for people.
Yeah. So there's going to be all these places where we have to, like, play this, like, whack-a-mole game. I mean, that's what it is.
You think the HA, do you think the Housing Accountability Act can help there?
No. I think for this, there's a couple things that'll help. One is when we did our regional housing needs allocation numbers, the RENA numbers that SB 35 is based on, when we did those numbers last, they were developed in the middle of the recession. And so all of the numbers are based on, like, faulty jobs projections, right? They're based on, like, oh, what if our economy continues to be shitty? And so all of the RENA numbers are way artificially low. We have to reform how we do RENA. And so that, like, the SB 35 stick will apply in more cases so that we can whack more people over the head with it. Right, so, like, San Francisco's RENA numbers are crazy low, right? So we've technically more than matched
We're like 200%
our,
above yeah. our market rate
right.
RENA number.
But that was based on our jobs recession
like the world
numbers.
Had fallen apart.
Yeah.
And it was never coming back.
Exactly. So, like, the RENA number for San Francisco makes no freaking sense. And RENA itself and ABAG was saying, like, oh, RENA's a floor, not a ceiling, right? But now everybody is like, oh, well, we've met our arena number, so they're treating it like a ceiling.
And rent went down.
And, yeah, well, yes. So we at least did that.
Kind of.
Okay, we need people to at least meet their arena numbers, but, like, we should be aiming for more because, like, yeah, we could do better.
That's why the supply and demand argument is done, because we actually produced the amount of housing that people were like, hey, maybe this is a good idea.
I didn't realize it was done. Was there like a big declaration party?
Yeah. Oh, you missed it?
I did, apparently.
Yeah.
Didn't get the invite.
I mean, I would love supply and demand argument being dead. But whatever. And Richmond Special. That's our last thing. Sam. Ooh. Sam, good. Tell us about the Richmond Special.
The Richmond Special is the replacing of basically vacant single-family homes with multifamily buildings so that people can move out to the Richmond. While they might be aesthetically not as nice as some things, saying that you don't support a Richmond Special is really saying that you don't support more people moving to your neighborhood. And this has been a public service announcement by Sam.
When did Richmond Special start to be a thing?
Late 70s. 80s, right around there.
Oh my god, in the 70s and 80s, they were taking single-family homes and turning them into, like, six-unit buildings?
The horror.
The horror. And how do people, like, survive when, like...
They don't.
I mean, that's Todd.
What did I do?
It was Todd's generation that was doing it.
Oh, you're saying, yeah. My generation sucks. So, just say it.
Recently, we had at Seacliff an example of what might be construed as a Richmond Special. It was a one-unit building being converted into a three-unit building.
Woo! It was a tiny little shack of a single-family home that had been abandoned and vacant for a long time, being converted to a three-story, three-unit building with a roof deck. And
scandal.
People were mad. But on the side, it turned my dad into a full-fledged EMB. So thanks, Dad.
Because three stories... And three units is completely irresponsible.
It would be bringing these downtown builders.
Six units over three downtown stories. Downtown
builders?
Yeah, it's downtown builders with their downtown values.
with the song as they go.
Yeah.
Uptown girl.
Okay, so there's like two.
Billy Joel's there.
There's two ideas that are in many people's heads in San Francisco that are like opposites, right? One is every neighborhood is its own little universe and, like, completely detached from every other neighborhood, and you should think about, like, how special and precious this little neighborhood is.
Well, you don't live in my neighborhood, so.
Yeah, so you can't possibly understand.
There's no more room in North Beach.
Right. There's no more room in North Beach. Like, you can't possibly understand my experience because you live 10 blocks away and you just don't even know what it's like. And then you have the same people saying, well, San Francisco is only 7x7. It's so geographically small that we can't possibly handle no more room. And I'm like, how can you be like, San Francisco is so small, aka you can run a bus anywhere, and and also hold in your head that every micro neighborhood is its own universe. Like, those two ideas are the opposite.
It sounds like we should probably not spend our time convincing those people that they're wrong and rather spend our time engaging other people.
Out there that agree with it's us true. Or think they might want to agree with us.
Let's win democracy through the other people.
Saving democracy.
I love it.
YIMBY action.
Yes, that.
And the San Francisco Housing Action Coalition.
And...
which I'm a board member of both, full Mission disclosure. Mission Housing. And Mission Housing, the greatest affordable housing developer in the history of all time.
Because we need more subsidized affordable housing in every neighborhood across the city and across the Bay Area.
Oh my god, you're drunk. Shut up. Bye! Okay, guys, I'm going to... The more you talk, the more
But that's
I
why you
edit.
Invited three men on, right? To just talk over you while you're talking.
Great.